Hello and welcome to UEG Journal Podcast, your quick dive into the latest and most impactful research in gastroenterology. I am Dr. Mohsin Subhani, Trainee Associate Editor for UEG Journal and Clinical Assistant Professor of Gastroenterology at the University of Nottingham, UK.
And I'm Maria Manuela Svinho, Trainee Editor of the UEG Journal and Gastroenterologist and Assistant Professor in Porto, Portugal.
Thank you very much for joining us, Manuela. So together with Manuela, we will be guiding you through five standout articles have been published in UEG Journal.
That's right. In just under 20 minutes, we'll break down the key findings, why they are important and matter for your clinical practice. So whether you are on your commute, in between clinics or grabbing a coffee, stay with us for a fast, focused roundup of cutting-edge gastroenterology.
So, Manuela, to start with, we would be summarizing a recent clinical guideline by UEG and European Society of Neurogastroenterology and Motility. This is a consensus guideline on chronic nausea and vomiting. And as a GI physician, we all appreciate this is very common presentation we come across both during inpatient admission and while doing the outpatient clinics. The population level prevalence of chronic nausea and vomiting is almost over 1% and is often very challenging to manage with recurrent hospital admission and recurrent attendance to outpatients. In this context, a multidisciplinary team of experts across the Europe, along with different representatives from these societies, came together to design a guideline. They used Delphi consensus process, and initially 98 statements were chosen based on published literature that includes systematic reviews, RCTs, and observational studies, and these statements were subsequently voted on. When we come to the guideline, it consists of three main sections. So first, it emphasizes on the importance of ruling out secondary causes early. That is everything from metabolic disorders like uremia, hyperthyroidism, to pharmacological triggers, vagal nerve injuries, and even psychiatric conditions such as anxiety or eating disorder. In this context, I found Table 1 is very helpful on day-to-day clinical practice and provides you a good list of the causes that you need to go through while managing these patients. Second, guideline covers GI motility disorders. This include gastroparesis, so vomiting, pain, bloating, and early satiety are often dominant. And there is a high quality evidence that gastric emptying studies is crucial for diagnosing gastroparesis. The guideline also reminds us to differentiate between regurgitation and rumination from true vomiting, especially since rumination is an effortless, unconscious process and require a very different management approach with diaphragmatic breathing as first-line therapy. Finally, the guideline addresses gut-brain interaction and a disorder related to it. And these conditions include cyclical vomiting syndromes with population-level prevalence over 2%, cannabinoid hyperemesis syndrome, nausea and vomiting syndrome, and rumination syndrome. Cyclic vomiting syndrome is characterized by predictable vomiting episodes with asymptomatic periods in between. Whereas while dealing with these patients, it's also important to always ask about regular cannabis used and consider cannabinoid hyperemesis syndrome, which respond very well to the cessation of cannabis intake. The guideline also provide an algorithm to be adapted in clinical practice while managing chronic nausea and vomiting, and is very helpful guide while you going through the list of investigation and differential diagnosis.
So amazing. This is definitely a guideline to read. And what are your key takeaways?
This is a long document, but is very interesting read. So my key takeaway from this guidelines is that before labeling somebody with a functional GI disorder in this context with chronic nausea vomiting syndrome, always go through the other causes. In that context, there is a comprehensive list to go through. Secondly, vomiting, regurgitation, and ruminations are different conditions and would require different management pathways and approach. So it is very important to differentiate between them. And lastly, the cyclical vomiting syndrome and cannabinoid hyperemesis syndromes are both unrecognized. So while you are managing the patient with chronic nausea and vomiting, also keep in mind that these do occur and they require a very holistic approach in managing these patients. Lastly, to finish on this article, it is important to mention that in final 94 statements, 67s had low to very low quality evidence. And this highlights the importance of further research in this space.
Thank you, Mohsen. And now we'll move into the IBD field with a study titled Tofacitinib for the Treatment of Chronic Bursitis, a pilot study. We know that up to 15% of patients with ulcerative colitis who have surgery to create an ileoanal pouch will go on to develop chronic or antibiotic-resistant bursitis. These cases are really tough to manage with limited treatment options. Indeed, to date, only vedolizumab is approved for this condition. Tofacitinib, a JAK inhibitor already approved for moderate to severe UC, has shown some promise in small studies for bursitis. This recent publication in the UEG journal is the first prospective pilot trial to test tofacitinib specifically in this setting. In this open-label single-center study, 13 adults with ulcerative colitis and chronic or antibiotic-resistant bursitis were treated with tofacitinib at 10 milligrams twice a day for 8 weeks, and those who responded could continue with a lower dose of 5 milligrams twice daily. The main goal here was to see if patients reached clinical remission, which was defined as a bursitis disease activity index under 7 and at least a 3-point drop from their starting score. As for results, after 8 weeks, about 1 in 3 patients reached clinical remission and over half showed some level of clinical improvement. There was also a clear drop in clinical and total PDAI scores. However, there were not significant changes in inflammation or on endoscopy or under the microscope. Mild infections were fairly common, but very importantly, there were no serious heart-related or blood clot events.
Thank you, Manuela. That is very interesting. So I think this is a very interesting study. So what do you think how this study would change your clinical practice?
So I believe that the message here is that tofacitinib may offer a promising treatment option to control symptoms in these very hard-to-treat bursitis cases. Yet, it does not appear to drive mucosal healing in the short term, at least for now. It is a promising start, but we'll need for sure larger control trials before this becomes standard practice.
So now let's move on to hepatology. And the article we have chosen is around a condition which actually wake most of hepatologists overnight. It's a difficult to manage condition. So we will be talking about the use of non-selective beta blocker as a secondary prophylaxis for gastric varices. This study was published in UEG Journal and was titled Secondary Prophylaxis of Cirrhotic Gastric Variceal Bleeding, Addition to Non-Selective Beta Blocker to Endoscopic Combined Treatment. So as we all know, the gastric varices, although very rare compared to esophageal varices, but are very difficult to manage. And when they have active bleeding, their options are limited, often involved gastric glue, or consulting over IR colleagues. This study actually went into looking into after an initial endoscopic treatment, whether there's any scope for secondary prophylaxis with beta blocker in gastroesophageal varices type 1 or gastroesophageal varices type 2. This was a retrospective study which examines whether adding non-selective beta blocker to combine endoscopic treatment, that would meaning cyanoacrylate tissue adhesive plus esophageal varices ligation, could improve outcome in patients with GOV1 or GOV2 varices. The study included 490 cirrhotic patients, and after propensity score matching, they compared two balanced groups of 130 patients each. Those who received non-selective beta blocker in addition to endoscopic treatment versus who didn't receive non-selective beta blocker. and hear what we found. So what study showed, actually non-selective beta blocker, though, significantly reduced 5-year rebleeding rate from 46% to 31%. The author didn't find any evidence to support for survival benefit in this study. But interestingly, in a select subgroup of the patient who didn't have prior splenectomy did show improvement in overall survival after going on non-selective beta blocker and reduced rebleeding rates. So I think this adds to a mixed body of evidence, which we all know from historically published articles, and also Baveno 7 consensus, which recommend for esophageal varices, there is definitely a scope for adding non-selective beta blocker. But when it comes to gastric varices, the guidelines are very cautious and the data is very limited. In fact, in 2021, there was a network meta-analysis published which suggested that non-selective beta blocker alone are less effective than endoscopic therapies like adhesive treatment for preventing rebleeding, but combining them with may offer added benefit in select cases.
So what is the verdict? Will you use non-selective beta blockers in gastric varices?
Based on this study, I still doubtful there is enough evidence to change my clinical practice to start every single patient with gastric varices on a beta blocker. Definitely in esophageal varices, I would consider in appropriate clinical circumstances. So I may think in a select group of patients, as per this study highlighted, we may consider using non-selective beta blockers in addition to endoscopic treatment, but not in isolation.
Okay, thank you very much, Mohsen.
Thank you.
And now we'll dive into another important topic, disorders of the gut-brain interaction among European people with obesity to study their prevalence and burden of compatible symptoms. And while previous studies in selected clinical populations have hinted at a link in between obesity and disorders of the gut-brain axis, such as IBS or functional dyspepsia, we didn't actually know how common these symptoms are in people with obesity. This new European study aimed to bridge that gap by looking at how frequently these symptoms occur and what factors may be influencing them across 11 European countries. To help answer this, researchers use data from the Rome Foundation Global Epidemiology Study, which is an internet-based survey completed by over 20,000 adults. These authors compared the prevalence of disorders of the gut-brain axis in obese individuals versus those with a normal BMI or overweight, and also explored associated factors like psychological stress, non-GI symptoms, quality of life, and healthcare access. And the results of this study recently published in the UEG journal were striking. Indeed, disorders of the gut-brain axis were more common in people with obesity, affecting 44% compared to 39% in the normal overweight group, and this difference was statistically significant. Interestingly, all disorders from this group were more common in obesity, except for functional constipation, which was slightly more frequent in those without obesity.
Thank you, Manuela. I think these findings are very important and again highlight that how underdiagnosed these conditions are and understanding is not that great. So looking into this study, so what does this mean to your clinical practice?
So, well, first, this highlights that these disorders of the gut-brain axis are just not clinical curiosities. They are indeed frequent, both in the general population, but even more in people with obesity. This means that we need to be proactive in identifying and managing these conditions in the broader setting and probably not just in specialist clinics. And secondly, recognizing the overlap with psychological and somatic symptoms can help us tailor more holistic treatment strategies. I believe that in the end, these findings reinforce the need for integrated care that goes beyond just BMI in patients with obesity.
Excellent. Thank you. The very excellent summary, Manuela. So, now let's move on to our last article and let's turn our attention to something very relevant to most gastroenterologists and especially the people who've been practicing IBD. And I think that's very close to your interest as well.
So absolutely, Mohsen. So now we'll be talking about a new systematic review network meta-analysis that is titled Endoscopic Techniques for Colorectal Neoplasia Surveillance in Inflammatory Bowel Disease, which I invite everyone to read.
So this study compared 7 different endoscopic techniques, including dye-based chromoendoscopy, DCE with high definition, standard white light endoscopy, and several virtual chromoendoscopy methods like narrowband imaging, eye scan, and autofluorescence.
So exactly, this study included 16 randomized trials with over 2,500 patients. And the key outcome here was that dye-based chromoendoscopy was the only technique that significantly improved neoplasia detection rates in comparison to standard definition white light endoscopy.
Yes, and while dye spray had the best detection performance, it comes at a cost. It requires the longest withdrawal time, which could impact feasibility in routine practice, but we all know it has been routinely used across most European centers.
Yes, that's right. Interestingly, high-definition white light endoscopy with targeted biopsies ranked just behind dye-based chromoendoscopy in effectiveness. So when we don't have dye-based chromoendoscopy available, probably high-definition white light endoscopy with targeted biopsies may be the next best option to consider.
And when it comes to virtual chromoendoscopy techniques like NBI, FICE, or iScan, it's interesting to know that results were not that interesting or that were not that significant. They didn't show any significant advantage over standard definition scopes in this analysis either.
And I believe that's a big deal, especially since some guidelines and some tech developers have been pushing virtual chromoendoscopy. This study brings us back to basics. Indeed, dye-based methods still reign supreme, especially when combined with random biopsies.
Yes, Manuela, and I also would like to draw your attention to practical takeaway when I read this study. So if you are a practicing IBD physician, so based on this study, dye spray is the best way of surveying those patients for colorectal cancer. But as we discussed, if somehow logistically it's not possible to use dye spray, then the high-definition white light endoscopy with targeted biopsy is next best option.
Thanks, Mohsen, definitely. And as a final note, this study also emphasized the need for updated RCTs, particularly in the aging populations, as well as newer imaging platforms. So I believe there's a lot more to come in this space. And so this brings up to the end of today's episode. Thank you so much for tuning in. And if you found this helpful, please like, subscribe, comment and share it with your colleagues. And don't miss our next episode. And along with other important studies, we'll be diving into the latest clinical recommendations on esophageal and oropharyngeal dysphagia. Until then, please take care and keep questioning the evidence. See you.